the Living 1982 podcast. Were you into the punk scene in the very early 80s or someone who discovered the genre along the way? Well, we're doing some deep diving into the Seattle punk scene and sharing the story behind a band that was very short-lived but made a lasting impact with members going on to being in some of the biggest bands in the world. Their debut album was never released back in the day but is finally out now. This is the story of The Living.
In fact, right. on today's episode of the Living 1982 podcast, we're joined by Greg Gilmore, the drummer from Living 1982 session, of which our talk is about to begin. How did you end up being in The Living? Back in 1982 in Seattle, we had a magazine called The Rocket, which was the local music tabloid. Well, a local entertainment tabloid, actually. It came out. I think originally it came out once a month, and then after a while it was twice a month. And one of the things that they had, which was very useful, was musicians classified. And I believe they were free.
I think so, yeah.
I'm not sure about that, but I think maybe they were free up to a point or something like that. And my own band, the Fastbacks, who were always in need of a drummer, were no stranger to putting ads in the Rocket classifieds once. And we almost started making a joke about it, like if anybody was really following it, it would be like, once again, we're in need of a drummer, must play fast music and arrangements. And so do you remember what the Rocket ad that you responded to, what it said?
No way. I don't remember at all. Yeah, that's really a great question. That's really good. That makes me curious now. What was it?
Something about it, stand out from all the other similar ads.
Yeah.
And of course, back then, in the beginnings of the local metal scenes, it was always, good attitude required, equipment and hair a must, or something like that, right? Wasn't that kind of the joke about the ads? You gotta have professional gear, professional attitude, hair a must.
That's great. You're so good at that. Yes. Yeah.
And looks, of course, equipment and attitude were important in ours, but it was like a particular kind of equipment and bad attitude must. the equipment was such that maybe no drum cages and a bad attitude, and that's about it.
Do you have an official tally for the number of drummers that played with the Fastbacks?
No, I don't. It hasn't changed in the past 20 years because we haven't done anything.
Yeah.
It could be researchable. There is the Fastback superfan Scott Lee did make a pie chart of all the different drummers and the amount of music that each of them had recorded. No, it doesn't necessarily reflect the live performance,
right,
or amount of time spent in the band, because some drummers were in for a long time and had little released music, and then some drummers were in for a short time and had much recorded music. But anyway, I'd imagine there's got to be about a dozen, over the 20-year span.
Yeah.
Greg Gilmore, never actually in the Fastbacks, but we did practice with you once.
It was close, yeah.
In the basement of that, it must have been the...
the house where Lulu and did Kim and Lulu live there?
sort of Wedgwood-y.
Yep.
It was near Duff's parents' house, correct?
It was out there where, yeah, everybody lived and came from out there at the time.
And I remember you know, Duff's parents, or Duff's, at least his mom, just lived down the street.
Yeah.
Wow.
Todd's mom, that where the living rehearsed when I met them and first joined, was out there.
And okay, so you respond to this ad in the Rocket, and you know, you called them up, of course, because you talked on the phone. There was no other.
Would have been the old telephone then,
Oh.
probably a touch tone at least.
Maybe not a dial, because
No.
you know, those may have been out at that time, but
Yeah.
out of favor anyway. And whoever you got on the phone, John Conti or you know Todd or Duff, and
Yeah, I don't know. I'm guessing it was probably John, most likely. And so yeah, I dragged my drums over there like we used to do.
Black Rogers kit.
But at that time, I went through this phase, you probably remember, using a couple of, they were both Ludwig snare drums that now, today, in retrospect, sadly, I modified and was using them as mounted toms. Remember that? They were white.
I guess I sort of remember that. Cannibalized Ludwig snare drums.
I still have them. I wish they were the snare drums that
Once for
they were before I went
pounds.
at them with drill and spray can, but
Yeah.
oh,
Well, you know, if you have time
so.
this week, you can fill some holes, and the you know you, the, if it's you know spray paint over a steel finish, you could probably get that off.
No, it was some, both of them were a variation on some, a classic, you know, purloined wrap. They were just cool from, you know, in every way.
Yeah, cool in every way. Now,
Yeah.
make a couple little timbales if you need them.
Yeah. So,
So you
whatever.
dragged the drums down to was it Todd's parents' basement?
Walk up to the door. There was a little bit of a, you know, I don't, the way I'm remembering it, a couple of, you know, one or two steps from the door down to where I would have been standing in front of the door. And Todd, who is an imposing figure anyway, you know, opens the door, blue haired. And I remember being slightly taken aback. Whoa. But that was it.
Well, how about this?
Yep, that was it. They're all very affable and friendly. And I hardly remember anything about, you know, playing. But it was, you know, it happened pretty quick. It was, let's do this, or you want to join it?
Yes, I can imagine. You know, once you started playing, it was probably clear that, oh, you know, whether or not they tried out other people before that, I don't know. I should ask if there was if there's other people, because I mean, there again, remembering our own my own drummer issues and Rocket, and people would seem like they had a grasp on, you know, what was back then underground music. It was not, you know, it was still, even by 1982, it was not music that was heard in the bars. And you know, coming up in the you know 7 or 8 years later, where people were used to hearing original music in clubs and stuff like that, it was, and this was, you know, pretty hard-edged and pretty radical music for the time for people that were listening to new wave music, and they were not, it was still something different. So a lot of the people that would call up were, in our minds, holdovers from the old guard. They were, people who played, well, I went downtown and did this, and we're looking, it's like, well, so how often do you guys gig? Do you take in some money? It's like, no. And we started putting all our ads in the Rocket at that point. So more negative than positive. It's like, got to have an okay drum set. We're not a gigging band. We don't play in bars. We don't play covers. We don't do this. We don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. It's like, because people would call up, and I believe I told you once that, one guy even called up that played the flute too. And he was
really?
Well, yeah, maybe, in one part of a song, if it doesn't need drums, I could come out from behind the kit and play a little flute, solo or something like that. It's like, whoa. And we're just like, originally I thought, you're crazy. And then I started thinking, certainly Genesis had, some flute solos and things like that back then in the early to mid 70s and stuff. And I thought that was cool, but it's like, are you paying attention? This is not, has nothing to do with that kind of music. It's not that. So we just like laughed, like, no. And even it got to the point where people would show up with their drum set and bring it. We'd like, you could tell just by looking at the drum set that the guy wasn't going to be right.
Too many funny cymbals and too many drums.
Yeah. And then ultimately, once you get the meat and potatoes of the style down, then, add the funny upside down cymbals and the, the weird stuff, it's fine. Or, little rototoms. I was looking at the Fastback's 1982 video from up the Commodore in Vancouver, and our drummer Richard has three rototoms.
Oh, did you really? Yeah.
And grounds for ridicule for sure, but at the same time, looking back, it's like, that kind of rules. it's really bold for somebody in a kick-ass punk band to have stuff like that and
that kind of equipment.
So anyway, you're down there playing with the living, and it's Duff and John Conti and Todd Fleischman in his mom's basement,
Todd's mom's, yeah.
Clearly you guys played some songs and like, yeah, this is cool. And then what happened?
Then we just started rehearsing, and it seems like we did it frequently.
Right. As you would, because yeah. I mean, I know that we don't know what the date of your, this audition was necessarily. We don't know exactly when it was. It had to have been, probably very early 1982.
Yeah. I was thinking more about that recently, and that Chris Iding had left his last show was sometime in December.
Right. I have a December 11th show at St. Joseph's Hall, Silly Killers, The Living and the Fastbacks, with Chris. And the little thing I have says Chris on drums.
Yeah.
So that was December 11th.
I remember seeing. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. What?
Oh, I don't remember I don't know for sure if that was his, if that was the last show that they did. But.
Right. Well, then it's so strange to me now. I'm imagine most people have this experience with aging, but when I look back on that period and realize, from my perspective now, when I think of all the things or all the significant moments in my life that were happening then, I think, well, that had to be a period of, you know, some years, because that's how long it takes for significant things to happen. When you start teasing this apart and realizing, oh my God, the living lasted for just a few months.
Right, right. If you went down and met those guys in January 1982, which, you know, could have easily been January or February, or like, and the last living show that we know is Roscoe Louis Gallery, July 30th, 1982. So that's like 8 months tops that band existed, and never that combination of people, I don't believe, ever got together again.
We carried on without John, or we attempted to for, but it could not have been long, you know, I don't know, couple 3 weeks, mm-hmm. maybe, and before seems that we were all just in that moment feeling like the pool is drained and
which seems weird. It seems like you know, in hindsight, it seems like the seeds of a dynamite band could have been there, but
and it was, you know, and it was, and that's another aspect of growing up a little bit,
is not seeing something great that could be
understanding that, well, this is, rather than the time to just bag it and go do something else, this is the time to just knuckle down and persevere a little bit.
Because it almost seemed like back in that era, you know, things so often worked so great with so little effort. Like, I mean, you showing up and playing, I'm sure, you know, I wasn't there, but I'm pretty sure I can imagine what it was like. It was like, wow, it just sort of had a mind of its own and it took off and it was great. And as a lot of really great things in the rock music world, you get together with, you know, three or four people, start playing some music, and bang, it's just like, oh yeah, you know, maybe we could use a little fine tuning, a little rhythm section, you know, clarity or something like that, but everything's there and it just sounds tough and exciting. And if it doesn't, it's really easy to just ignore, you know, move on. Just because you're, you know, like, oh, we're great. So you think that everything that's good should be very easy and work great instantly. As things were then also, you get together with a combination of people and you'd be playing a show 2 weeks later, you know, like instantly shows weren't booked 4 months, 5 months, 6 months in advance at local clubs as they are now. You know, you could have a band and call the person who booked shows at a club and say, oh, or at a, you know, at the Metropolis at all ages, or, you know, wherever it would be, and say, oh yeah, got this band and it's cool. Okay, well, yeah, why don't come down, you know, next Wednesday and there's a show. Okay, and you go to the thing and make some flyers and tack them up and tell all your friends, and you'd get, you know, a couple dozen buddies down there, and you know, things were quickly done, which is not the case anymore. But then if you think, oh, well, we can be a three-piece band, and you try it and maybe you practice once and it's like, oh, this isn't exactly lighting up the basement. It's like, oh, give up and do something else. You know, well, there's we did that for, you know, 8 months, now time to move on to something else, I guess. I mean,
That's all I kind of remember is that feeling of just the three of us at practice one day, and just the air, the feeling in the room was just kind of, it's just gone.
What made you think it was time to go record? Like, you know, was it just something that you know, because back then too, like, nobody had home studios, nobody, recording was not simple or inexpensive or easy.
It was a bit of a commitment, wasn't it?
It was, you know, but I think there was studios around. It was, you know, it was possible to do that, but it was not, you know, it was always more money than anybody had. You know, so was it maybe it was Brian Fox's idea to go record, or was it, were you guys just like, you know, let's take this to the next level and record these songs that we have?
Yeah, you know, I have no recollection at all of how that came about. I definitely don't remember any group conversations about what should we do next. Ever a conversation like that. Such
right. Blatant. Oh yeah. You're either arguing about how a song should go, or, you know, playing, or
figuring out how you're gonna get your gear downtown.
Right. How are we gonna get down to the gorilla room? Okay, well, what do you remember about the actual recording session, which was at American Music, which is a guitar store here in Seattle, or a music instrument store, but they also had a studio, which
what is now the drum department there. That's
what the recording studio was in the building there.
Yes, that was the studio. Classic 8-track, I'm guessing 1/2 inch,
mm-hmm.
probably.
Yeah, maybe a 40-4, I think, was the classic 1/2-inch 8-track.
At that time, yeah.
I never went there, although the Living recorded there, the Silly Killers recorded there, their 45 was recorded there, as well as the Veins. Which was Duff and Chris Utting and Andy's band from 1980.
Oh, really? They had been at that same. I don't think I was aware that all of those bands had used that same.
Yes, yeah, so all those things are recorded there, and you know, I don't know why I never, because I'd go to American Music. It was the music store of choice, you know, at that point. And if there was a recording studio, you'd think that, being a recording aficionado, I might have at least tried to poke my head in there or gone while you guys were setting up to.
Well, you did, though, when we were mixing. Duff got you down there as a, you know, sort of a advisor at one point, for one moment at least. You.
Yeah, gosh, I don't remember ever being in there, but
I'm pretty
sure. But I also know that everything I remember is not particularly accurate.
I can relate to that feeling.
Yeah,
you may not have ever recorded there, but you at least, that is one thing I'm really sure about.
Yeah.
You were there at least for, you know, briefly to kind of give us some support or perspective on
the. Right, because the original mix of The Living 1982, if I remember correctly, was a little bit skewed against the singer.
Oh, yeah. Like,
well, I can tell there's a singer in there somewhere, and I, you know, getting a lot of guitar, you know, which sounded cool, but at the same time, it's like, well, you know. So you guys go in there, maybe you record most of the songs on one day. It's an 8-track studio. I'm sure it was very quickly done.
Yes, yeah, for sure. That was, you know, an afternoon work with tracking.
And then did you record vocals on the same day? I know that you went back and recorded a couple more songs a few, you know, a little while later, not probably not too long later.
Yeah, no, the first five songs, and they are the first five songs on the record, they were done at that first session, and everything was recorded in a day, in an afternoon. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were really ready to go.
Now, so you were given a digital transfer of these sessions, of these two recording sessions, which you mixed to give us the record that we have now.
Yeah.
I'm guessing, you know, there, if it was an 8-track, if the drums were on two of the tracks, or maybe three.
Three, kick, snare, and everything else.
Oh yeah, okay, so snare, drum, and stereo, everything else.
Pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you know, of course, yeah. That was a common way to do that if you had three tracks and wanted a stereo drum mix, that would be the way to go. And
three tracks, kick, one, snare, two, and mono.
And rest, yeah. Of kick. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Pretty sure.
Which ultimately is better from a remix standpoint to have the kick drum on a separate track.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And you spent a little bit of time down in the basement. Oh, I don't know where you're up.
Yeah. It's in the old basement. Yeah.
And was it fun to revisit that nearly 40 years ago thrill of the earliest known recordings of Greg Gilmour?
It was actually, it was a lot of fun. It was so much fun. I did it twice. That I don't even remember now how far back this goes. It seems like a good 10 years nearly. You know, this all came up quite a while back, and we were going to release the record. And I mixed it, and then that broke down. And then maybe I was doing it just for my own amusement, not really being happy with those mixes and having no outlet for them. I just sat down and sometime later and started to play around with mixing them again. And then we had another deal, and those mixes were going to be used for that. But anyway, whatever it is now, 3 or 4 deals later, the record is finally coming out. And so this is the second. The mixes I did originally are not for using. Yeah, I did it again. Yeah.
Right, right. And you know, not unheard of in the the current state of recording, where you can, you know, go back and pick up where you left off or start new. But I mean, it's possible to do that in a way that of course wouldn't have been so possible back then, if, you know, 10 years later to do a remix. I mean, you really have to start from the ground up. And, you know, it's fun. You know, it's cool to old recordings and you know, try to do what you can to, you know, not necessarily enhance what's there, but present it in a way that sounds like it did then.
To sort of uncover it. Yeah. And that was what I did when I went back to mix them the second time. You know, I didn't have, I might have come up with, either I found one myself or I got one from somebody, a cassette. From of the original mixes, mm-hmm. which obviously by now just it sounds, you know, so it's so deteriorated. It's it sounds awful, but I had already without that in my mind, I just a memory kind of what the mixes had sounded like to me then. And I did try to listen to a cassette, whatever that is, 40, 35 years later, to try to reinforce that memory. And it may or may not have, it's hard to say, but I did, when I went back to mix them the second time, I was really trying to work with where I had remembered them sounding rather than, you know, reimagining them.
Right. And you know, the beauty of an 8-track or even a 4-track recording is, you know, there's, other than purposefully ruining things by slathering a bunch of, you know, digital reverb on it, you know, it's pretty easy. There's, you know, so much of it is sort of preordained.
It's baked in, yeah, it's kind of.
Right. And especially and you know, an 8-track studio back in 1982 is not going to be loaded with outboard gear. And of course, back then, you know, you wanted all that stuff. You wanted the AMS reverb, and you wanted you wanted all this fancy stuff, and you know, you wanted gates on all the toms, and all these things that, but I mean, you didn't have them. And so you just did the best, you know, like the stuff you'd hear about. It's like, oh yeah, you put, you know, gates on the toms and do 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 do, and you know, that's cool and everything, but in an inexpensive studio you just don't have them. And if, you know, if you're recording all the drums to one track, you know, you can't really do that, because if something triggers wrong, it's printed and you can't go back. And I know that's probably not that to the layman who might be listening to this, but you know, it was very important back then. I mean, you do anything you can to get a killer sound in a studio, because you wanted your recordings to sound like, you know, killer, you know, like British punk bands, or you want them to sound like the Germs album or something, that everything was well recorded. And there was two things going against you, the least of which was the equipment, the most of which is nobody had any experience doing anything, and nobody was really good at anything. But you know, you'd hear the records and you'd get frustrated when your record didn't sound as good as theirs, and you'd start like, blah, 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 you know, yelling at the engineer. I mean, I'm not saying you guys did, because yours turned out fine. You know, you just get frustrated, and it's like, well, why doesn't it sound like this? Oh, and not the least of it being, you know, your own ability in the sound.
Because you didn't play it like that.
You don't sound like that. You're not playing like that. And, you know, there's a full detachment between, you know, your band and not your band, but other bands in the technology and whatever. So it was frustrating, but but that studio ended up like the living, the Silly Killers record sounds great. The Veins record sounds great. You know, whatever they were doing there, Brad, what was his name?
Brad Spurr.
Brad Spurr. You know, for, you know, he must have had a pretty good, style, you know, because he made it happen.
He was real good. So he did, you think he did all of those other recordings?
Well, they were all done at that studio. Now, I don't know if there was somebody else there that was an engineer, but they all have a, you know, a sound of, you know, somebody knew what they were doing, because for sure the Veins stuff and Chris's band of early 1980 certainly couldn't have had a clue what they were doing, you know. And for them to walk out of there with three songs recorded for their single that sound as good as they do, you know, somebody there must have been, you know, pretty good guidance. And those guys were 8 or 16 years old.
Yeah.
And it's not like they had, you know, their parents there, you know, older, wiser parents like, well, when I was in a band, we used to do this. And, you know, I want to do this for my kids and stuff. It was nothing like that. There was no parents at that session. It's just a bunch of dorky punk rock kids, you know, in a studio with a guy that made it happen. And, you know, that was a rarity back then, you know, because usually the band would start playing and the engineer would go, oh God, this is terrible. You know, first stop the cymbal so hard, turn the guitar down. You can't record with that much distortion on a guitar. You know, those things really did happen.
That's the same, similar, that pet peeve of mine, that there was a time when a snare drum was not allowed to ring for a recording. You have a wallet or something you can tape on that thing. Oh, please.
I can dig both sides of that story. You know, like a douche, you know, snare drum or a clang kind of snare. Both are good.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like, just not, you know, not understanding what the whole sound of something is supposed to be like is bad for the engineer, because unless they just, you know, put mics on it and say, well, whatever you guys do, you know,
whatever you put in those microphones, it's on you.
Yeah. I'm just here to put the microphones on. I'm not here to make any decisions. It's like, and you know, I understand that too, but it's like, oh, you know, you could make this a little bit better by, you know, actually tuning those toms so that they don't just go puh, that they actually, I don't know, some things that you could do, or yeah, hey, maybe I'll stop and tune that guitar a little bit, you know, or something like that. You know, just helpful.
Just get involved.
Get involved. Yeah, the E string on the bass is totally, you know, not in tune up the neck. Give me 5 minutes and let's adjust it so it, you know, plays in tune a little bit better. You know, like, you know, the caliber of gear that people played on back then was generally pretty low caliber.
It's questionable, yes.
And, you know, to be able to reek a little bit of quality out of, you know, falling apart, breaking. I know there's a romantic side to that. Oh, it's like, yeah, we just played crappy gear. I mean, and a lot of times crappy gear just sounds crappy no matter what you do. But if, you know, if you can get it to sound pretty good, then you're, you know, not necessarily.
Yeah. Depends on what you do with that crappy sound, you know?
Yeah.
If you're owning it, then hey, you're going to make something happen. But if you're
honing it,
well, that's what comes out, then yeah. Prospects are not high.
And after the living sort of just, you know, stopped, did you play with anybody else? I know that you came down and practiced with the Fastbacks once. Because
is that when I came?
Our last shows were the same show, which was, our last show was Monroe's Dance Palace with DOA and The Living, which was June, I think, 19th, 1982. And after that, our drummer Richard and our other guitar player Lulu parted ways for reasons unknown. And so that Roscoe Louis show, which was July 30th, was our record release show.
Right.
Which we originally weren't going to play at because we didn't. It was only me and Kim, the guitar player and bass player, singer. So we didn't even have a whole band. So it's like, well, let's still do this record release party and with a living we'll play. And so that ended up being that. And then our Lulu and Richard, the drummer and other guitar player, both decided that they would bless us with their presence and come to the show and play some songs. So we did, and you guys played And that was the last time the Living played a show, and as far as I know, and we were all sort of out of, you know, everything had kind of, you know, fallen off the merry-go-round at that point. The wheels were off, and I believe that, I mean, that would make sense if that was the time that you came down and
yeah.
Would have been in 1982 at some point.
Wow. Except it seems I came over more than once. Is that possible? And because I'm remembering, and Lulu, Lulu was gone then too? Because I don't, Lulu was there when I came.
Well, I think Kim and Lulu lived in that house together. I mean, they were both there, and it was, you know, there was, you know, parties all the time.
No, but when I was there to play.
Oh, I see what you mean. She was
there practicing. Because I remember when you and Lulu would start going at it, and then Kim and I would drift upstairs and hang out.
I remember that basement practice room was just. It was bad news. I mean, it was just like so much fighting, arguing for what reason, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess I should clarify. That what I mean by going at it is that you guys were at loggerheads over some.
Yeah, over something. I don't want to play that chord.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the song though. Well, I'm just not gonna play it. That's stupid. You're stupid. Oh.
I love that. I love that kind of that dialogue, that band, those moments. I just won't play that note then.
I just
won't play on that section.
Which always is fine. If you just don't want to play for a little while, it'll sound better when you come back in. But that was never the reason for not playing. It's like, I'm not going to play on that part because I don't like that chord and I think you're stupid. So, okay. So, I mean, this is not appropriate to the Living particularly, but it makes a lot of sense that our drummer may have bailed. Lulu's still being in the band. We get you down there to practice once. It doesn't really like take off as, you know, as we were really talking about it, like things either just launched and were perfect or they weren't. And, and so me and Kim go upstairs, Lulu and I are down in the basement practice room, arguing and yelling at each other. And maybe that was that, around that time, she may have just said, I don't need this. I don't need all, you know, cause I don't know. I don't really know why she ended up not being in the Fastbacks at that point, but you know, we were clearly not so angry with one another that we didn't do two more shows while we were broken up.
Yeah, it was the fall of 84 when Duff and I went to LA. And Duff was, he started talking about it first. He pitched the idea to me and his... that was his view was, you know, we've done it here. Dudes, we gotta go to where the action is.
Right.
And so we did. For me, it turned out to be action that I just really could not connect with that place and the business. There, it wasn't, at least then, that was not the right place for me to be. But. And then I did not play much for a while. You know, maybe some random odds and ends. No regular band thing. And yeah, that might have been a couple of years. Then I went. I went on a long one-way ticket traveling backpacker trip to Southeast Asia for months, and then when I just right when I came back, I ran into Stone walking around up on Broadway. We didn't really know each other. I think we were barely acquainted, but he invited me to come down and play. That was the beginning of that. Oh, Mother Love Bone. So, yeah, there's kind of that that gap in there after I came back from L.A.
Right, right. And, you know, like I could imagine after banging your head against the wall and not getting anywhere for 6+ months down there, been a little bit, you know, frustrated and disillusioned, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, I don't really remember processing it much, but yeah, already in that short time, I do remember that. I mean, I wasn't disengaged or unplugged from the, I was going out and I knew what was, I came back and I saw what was happening. By that time, Green River, in fact, I did, there was a little bit of resurrected 10-minute warning, maybe, in that time after I came back. But then, by then, Green River was happening. Would that have been also when the U-Men were kind of a thing, like I'd made a record with Homestead, or?
Yeah, yeah, I think that would have been, eight, you know, 85 for sure. Yeah.
By that,
you're thinking Christmas, you know, just getting the years mixed up, but it seems like, you know, 85 was maybe the year that the U-Men did that, and, you know, 86 must have been sort of the like the Green River, U-Men, Homestead records, you know, put out records by both those bands, I believe.
That's right. Green River did something. Yeah.
They're on the shelf.
Yeah. Yeah. In that time, something had evolved. Something had changed. Something significant. The last, maybe sort of the last piece required for those earlier bands to finally connect with the world at large. I mean, not that the Living and certainly the Fastbacks weren't playing songs. It certainly were, but then like 10-minute warning represented another thing that wasn't. I mean, we called those they were songs, but they didn't have choruses. You know, like
it was music. It was rock music, but it was a little less song based than, you know, the other bands were for sure.
Yeah. And when I came back, I maybe typified mainly by say what Green River was up to. Like suddenly, okay, this whole thing has grown up a little bit. These guys have moved it to the next iteration closer to doing that thing. You know, they had the sing-along chorus, which is, you know, a requirement.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living 1982 podcast. Circle back for weekly episodes and find out about each week's special guests and where to stream the music by following the band's release on Instagram at The Living 1982.